Welcome to KBIA's True False Preview Special. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Over the next half hour, we'll get you primed and ready for this year's True False Film Fest. Since the middle of last week, you've been hearing our True False conversations, interviews with the filmmakers that help you go inside the creative minds of the people responsible for the films of True False. We do those each year in the lead up to True False, but this year we're also doing something new. We've teamed up with Vox Magazine to bring you reviews of 8 of the feature films screening this weekend, reviews which you're about to hear. Written and recorded by Vox's movie reviewers, we hope these will help you know what you can expect from some of this year's films. You're also going to hear portions of our interview with Stacey Wolfel, the director of MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism. KBIA's Ryan Levy sat down with Wolfel to get his list of the must-see films for this year's fest. You can hear an extended version of that interview on our website, kbia.org. But before we get to that, let's start with some of the reviews. Vox Magazine's Nikki Kottmann looks at one migrant's struggle to make it into Europe in her review of Those Who Jump.
Few movies manage to capture humanity in its most raw moments. Even fewer films capture these moments through the lens of people holding on to their humanity against all odds. Les Sauteurs, or Those Who Jump, does just that. German filmmakers Esteban Wagner and Moritz Siebert handed Malian refugee Abu Bakar Sidibe a video camera and asked him to document his journey from the mountains of Morocco to Malia, Spain. They were putting their faith in a man who didn't know how to make a film. The result was a piece of art that documents the human experience far more authentically than any professional videographer ever could. The story of Sidibe and his fellow refugees at the Moroccan camp is difficult to watch at times. Their journey includes many failed attempts over a fence, which serves as the literal and figurative obstacle in their fight for leur destin, or destiny, that they believe awaits them in Europe. Lives are lost and blood is shed during quarrels with police that are always awaiting them on the other side. All of this hardship is viewed through the perspective of Sidibe, whose storytelling techniques flourish as the film develops. As the men of the camp struggle to maintain a sense of hope, Sidibe never loses faith. His narration is absolutely breathtaking, and he uses a poetic style that proves it's possible to find beauty in life's ugliest moments. The film uses a recurring motif of a gunman's target being pointed towards the hills. It's a reminder of the extreme risk that these men are taking on a daily basis. But the boisterous soccer match, the joyful post-game victory dance, and the animated rounds of checkers remind us that life goes on. These men are trying to live their lives just like anyone else, but the circumstances under which they do so are remarkable. In one of the film's most moving scenes, a man is seen cleaning the camp while singing a song with a striking lyric: "If you never suffered, you know nothing about life." This film is about the suffering of many men, but the story within the story is how filmmaking gave a single man the strength to overcome it all in order to understand his true motivation to live.
Now, Vox Magazine's Ryan Levy digs into the home of hoarders in his review of Thy Father's Chair.
Thanks to Annie's Hoarders TV show, we have seen numerous homes filled with newspapers, rotting food, and the occasional dead cat. These images have come to define hoarding in our world. Those familiar images are all there in Thy Father's Chair, except thankfully all the cats we see are alive. But they still produce a consistent and overwhelming discomfort. The documentary follows Abraham and Shagra, Orthodox twin brothers who are forced to deep clean their Brooklyn apartment with the help of a professional cleaning crew. We get an up-close and personal view of the cleaning process. The camera stays tight on the brothers' faces as we see the cleaners slowly make their way through years of neglect. We learn from the brothers' neighbor that the place was cleaned less than 10 years ago, making the derelict state of the apartment even more crushing. The classic images of hoarding are all there. Boxes piled high, an unseeable floor, and a toilet that is beyond words. But they are given a new flavor through the distinct visual style of the film. Shots are consistently shaky, tilted, and out of focus, adding another layer of chaos and disorientation to the apartment. The viewer feels as if it's one of the poor schmucks that has been hired to find the home buried beneath all the stuff. The film is loosely broken up into 7 parts, although the directors say the cleaning actually took place over 8 days. This 7-part presentation of the transformative deep cleaning of the home of 2 Orthodox men has an almost biblical resonance. Out of a den of chaos and neglect, God-like cleaners are able to create a livable home in just a few days, even if that livable home does have some truly awful green shag carpeting. even in a seemingly condemned apartment in Brooklyn. Thy father's chair seems to tell us that rebirth can occur, at least for these two old men. So who are Abraham and Shagra? It doesn't really seem like it's that important. They look and act so similar that most of the time it's impossible to tell who is on the screen. Where Hoarder zeroes in on the personal stories behind the mess, thy father's chair could be about anyone. It's the apartment and its rebirth that is the film's true focus.
Now, Vox Magazine's Max Havey reviews Kate Plays Christine, directed by Robert Greene. Greene is also a faculty member at MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism.
At what point does telling someone's story exploit the sensational chapters of their life? How far does a woman working in journalism have to go to be taken seriously by her male counterparts? Is a documentary with a fictional conceit still a documentary? These are all questions at the heart of director Robert Greene's latest documentary, Kate Plays Christine. The story centers around actress Caitlin Scheel preparing to play the role of Christine Chubbuck, a Florida newswoman who killed herself live on television in 1974. Scheel travels to Sarasota, Florida, to immerse herself in Chubbuck's world. She visits the gun shop where Chubbuck bought her gun. She tries to track down the rumored video of Chubbuck's suicide that is an urban legend in and of itself. The more Scheel finds out, the more sympathetic she becomes to Chubbuck's story, and the more apprehensive she gets about filming the climactic suicide scene, which the film cuts back to over and over again. The film that Scheel's preparing for and is shown filming throughout the documentary is purely a dramatic construction for the documentary. But the interviews, the people, and the events depicted throughout it are all real. It isn't quite a melodrama and isn't completely a documentary, but some homogeneous mixture of the two, kind of like what Joshua Oppenheimer did in The Act of Killing. Greene played with melodrama as a dramatic device in his previous film, Actress, but utilizes it to its full extent in Kate Plays Christine. Scheel's performance here is a marvel, both in the journalistic intensity she brings to researching her role, as well as the anger she brings to her portrayal of Chubbuck. It not only allows the audience to understand what all is going through her head as an actress, but lets her explore deeper the issues that plagued Chubbuck, like dealing with depression and trying to be taken seriously as a female journalist. The entire film hinges on her, and she more than delivers. Kate Plays Christine is a complex puzzle box of a documentary. It does an incredible job showing the harrowing process Scheel goes through to understand Christine Chubbuck without discounting the character's struggles with depression or death. That, mixed with the expertly created melodramatic conceit of the film, makes for a compulsively watchable documentary that will leave audiences thinking long after they leave the theater.
I'm Ryan Famuliner, and you're listening to KBIA's True False Preview Special. Stacey Wolfel is the director of MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism. KBIA's Ryan Levy sat down with Wolfel to get his take on this year's True False films.
So obviously talking about True False today, let's start with, it's a big list, 40 films, but a little different than usual. You've only seen a few of these. Can you talk about the films that you've seen?
Sure. Yeah, it is a little different. Last year, I feel like I went into it having seen 8 or 9, maybe a quarter of the films. And this year, it's a little bit lower number, but happy to start with those. First on the list is the one that was directed by my teaching partner, Robert Greene. So Kate Plays Christine, which I think we are very lucky that it's showing a couple of times in a big venue in the Missouri Theater. So Thursday night, and I think again on Saturday, they've programmed it there because it's a really beautiful film, and not one when you hear the subject matter, you don't think this will be a beautiful film. It's about a TV anchor in 1974 in Sarasota who fatally shot herself on air. And so Robert approaches that story in a not very journalistic fashion, does it in an artistic fashion through bringing in an actress to play Christine Chubbuck, the woman who killed herself, and explore that part and explore that character. So that doesn't instantly think beautiful cinematography when you hear that description, but it really is. And I saw it on a large screen, though not as large as the Missouri Theater, at Sundance, having seen it on smaller screens before in our office, frankly. And the sound and the visuals are beautiful, and it's a fascinating and inventive telling of this story and a type of film that is really sort of a vanguard of what's to come. So I put that on anybody's list to go see. And it's a local filmmaker, so they get a chance to see a very high-level local filmmaker's work. The others I've seen, and my favorite at Sundance was Land of the Enlightened. and it's the story of some young children in Afghanistan, and they have formed this marauding pack of raiders, basically, at about age 12. And so they are robbing caravans and living really the only way they know how after having grown up with the war around them their entire lives. And it's all built, it's all embedded in this fable about how Afghanistan, how God formed Afghanistan, and how one day someone will rise to lead it. And so it's a documentary. There are some fictionalized elements. There's sort of a love story here that has some elements of fiction to it, elements of fable to it. Shot on 16-millimeter film, beautiful concept that the director, it's a first-time director, a Dutch director. Had a chance to speak with him a little bit at Sundance. He spent about 7 or 8 years making the film, was attacked by the Taliban in the middle of it, lost his entire European crew to insurance issues. They weren't killed, but lost them to be able to come back. So he finished with an Afghan crew. And so it's a great story of perseverance on his part. These children, while they're not lovable, are fascinating to watch, and you really feel for them and what they've grown up around. So Land of the Enlightened. On a completely different level, a film called Thy Father's Chair, which to me, as I watch it, and teaching documentary, helps to drive home the difference between documentaries and reality TV, because it is about three brothers, though we only see two on camera, three brothers in an apartment in New York who are hoarders. And it starts with the cleaning crew arriving to clean up their apartment, which is horrendous when you see it. But unlike the reality hoarding shows, which tend to be sort of freak shows where the characters aren't fully developed, we really get to know these brothers, and one in particular who's the main character that we see all the time. And we have this unlikely hero in the foreman of the cleaning crew, and what he does for these brothers as he goes through there. So it's a wonderful film. It's funny at times. It's disgusting at times. It's sad and it's uplifting at the same time, and well worth somebody's trip. It's simple, very simply made. It's not beautiful cinematography. It's adequate cinematography when it comes through it, but beautifully made all the same. And so that one I would definitely put very high on the list.
We'll come back to our interview with Murray Center director Stacy Wolfel in a bit. But first, let's listen to a few more of our reviews of true-false films from Vox Magazine. Max Havey explores Australian culture clash in his review of Another Country.
Working against the odds, David Gulpleel has had a successful career as an Aboriginal actor, most known for his role in the movie Crocodile Dundee. He grew up in the bush, where most Aboriginal people lived, until the government relocated them to Ramanjining, which is 400 kilometers from the nearest town. In her documentary, Another Country, director Molly Reynolds seeks to show what effect this government intervention has had on the people of Ramanjining, telling the story through the eyes of Gulpleel. As Gulpleel tells it, people have been fine living on their own for years until the government, or white fellas, as he calls them, came. The government insisted that the Aboriginal peoples needed a town and a school so they could be civilized, and lumped many Aboriginal clans together to create Ramanjining. Gulpleel says in the process, his people were left jobless, with only government handouts to get by on, and their traditional culture began dying out. Gulpleel, as the film's narrator, lends a matter-of-fact and occasionally sarcastic tone while recounting the history of Ramanjining and his people. He knows that he is the lucky one, the one who found success in a place where, for so many, there is no future. He sees potential in the people the government has given up on. He is using his fame to try and get the government to listen. His narration is often repetitive, emphasizing the urgency of the need. Many have nothing left to live for except preparing for traditional ceremonies or smuggling banned substances, like alcohol and marijuana, which leads to their arrest. Some commit suicide in jail. Gulpleel harps on this near the end of the film to underscore the hopelessness of the young people in Ramanjining, and the visions we see of them sitting around and playing cards confirm this. They have nothing left to do but cause trouble. Reynolds and cinematographer Matt Netheim weave together Gulpleel's narration with slices of life in the rundown and desolate Ramanjining. Streets covered with trash, ravines full of unusable products and broken-down cars. They look like scenes from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, but the disaster here wasn't a natural one. At its heart, Another Country is a heartbreaking portrait of the effect colonialism has on native people. Perhaps now, with the help of Gulpleel, the voices of the Aboriginal people will finally be heard, and they can find new ways to reignite their dying traditions.
Vox Magazine's Katie Johns looks at the life of a young Afghan girl who aspires to be a rapper, and her review of Sonita.
In Afghanistan and Iran, it's illegal for women to sing. It's also an Afghan tradition that women be sold into marriages. 18-year-old Sonita defies both of these in Rukhsare Game Megami's documentary, Sonita. The film follows her pursuit of becoming a rapper while highlighting the oppression that women from Afghanistan suffer. The first 30 minutes lull by until Sonita's dream of becoming a rapper and escaping the chains of arranged marriage become tested. Her mother comes to visit and tells her she needs to return to Afghanistan to get married. She is worth $9,000 as a bride, and her family needs that money so her brother can get married. The rest of the film follows her turbulent struggle with overcoming this oppression, including traveling back to Afghanistan for a passport and a chance to go to school in America. From the time she says that Rihanna and Michael Jackson are her dream parents to the time she produces a music video, audiences know Sonita is a force to be reckoned with. A mature yet personable girl, Sonita seems to become stronger throughout the film. She stands up to her mom, fights for her chance in a recording studio, and explores moving to America. The film does nothing cinematically extravagant, but it's the simplicity of the shots that bring the story home. The cramped house she lives in, the dirty street she walks, and the dim recording studios all add to the feeling of doubt that lingers throughout the film. Sonita separates itself from the cookie-cutter story about a young girl with a dream by blending women's oppression with innocent dreaming. The awkward silences and misplaced clips are brushed aside with recording of Sonita's own songs and conversations that push her fight against arranged marriage forward. Audience members watch Sonita grow up in the 91-minute film, and by the end, she has become a role model to those around her and an advocate for women everywhere. Her songs have meaning and purpose. They push her fight forward and portray her change the world attitude perfectly, as do the scenes playing them. In one of her first rap, she says, "Don't worry about me, my future is bright." And if the barriers she overcomes in the film are any indication, she isn't lying.
I'm Ryan Famuliner, and you're listening to KBIA's True False Preview Special. We're bringing you reviews of many of the films at this year's True False Film Fest. Let's go back now to Ryan Levy's interview with Stacey Wolfel, the director of MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism.
So those are a few of the films you've seen, but that leaves more than 35 films that you haven't seen. What are you really excited about, really keen to go see?
Yeah, I'm excited about a number of films. So Weiner, about Anthony Weiner, the politician, the congressman who resigned after a sexting scandal, sex on Twitter scandal, and then decided to make a comeback to run for New York City mayor. That one was at Sundance. I didn't get a chance to see it there, but the buzz was incredible. People saying it was one of the best or one of the best campaign documentaries ever done, and that's high praise. There are a lot of great campaign documentaries, and so co-directors on this one really sell it as a story of a guy that made some dumb mistakes, and everybody looks at Weiner and says, "Why would you do something like that?" But also something more telling the story of redemption on his part, attempt at redemption. Interestingly, interviewed before it premiered at Sundance, the directors thought, I think, and not put words in their mouth, but thought that Weiner would probably like it. Turns out he does not like it. If you read some of the follow-up on it, he says it's dishonest and disingenuous, I think was the phrase that he used. But that makes it more intriguing to me to see what he wouldn't like about it. No, it would be odd for any of us to have our lives depicted on the big screen in a documentary, but he's somebody who's chosen to live in the spotlight, so we'll see what he doesn't like about it. So that one's very high on my list. Another one called Sherpa, about the Sherpas that help people climb Mount Everest. And we're sort of in a mountain climbing Mount Everest sort of era right now. There was the Hollywood movie Everest that was out last fall that was pretty good. It was about the same sort of ill-fated climb that John Krakauer wrote about in Into Thin Air, though it's not based on his book. And that was a pretty good movie. I liked it. I actually reread Krakauer's book after I saw the movie because I wanted to go back over some things that were in there. And at True False last year, we had Maru, which is another mountain climbing movie. And so this one, I think, is going to be a little bit different than what people expect and what they saw in those films. Because it's not centered on these heroic European, North American climbers that we seem to see in these other films, but about the Sherpas who live on and around the mountain, that it's a sacred, holy place for them, and how they have assisted climbers, but also assisted maybe unwittingly in the destruction of a lot of the environment there. So it's beautiful. cinematography is breathtaking. The story is very real, and it's people that we probably should know more about and don't. So Sherpa is really, really high on my list.
We have three more reviews to share with you tonight as you prepare for this weekend's True False Film Fest. Vox Magazine's Madison Feller explores an alternative high school in California in her review of The Bad Kids.
Midway through The Bad Kids, there's a single shot of Lee and Layla walking uphill through the desert. There's no dialogue, no emotion, just teens carrying a baby and pushing a stroller up a steep roadway. For the entirety of the documentary, that is what you see. 11th and 12th graders trying to push, against all barriers, to make something of their lives. Set in California's Mojave Desert, The Bad Kids focuses on Black Rock High School, an alternative public school for students who are at risk of dropping out. Some of them don't have a stable place to stay, food to eat, clean clothes to wear, or people around to support them. Directors Keith Fulton and Lou Pepe zoom in on the stories of three teens trying to succeed at Black Rock. Black Rock's principal, Vonda Veland, and the other teachers and staff are the obvious heroes of the film. Veland calls students to wake them up in the morning, passes out milk, and greets everyone on their way into school. She counsels students day in and day out, with many of them breaking down in her office. She is the guidepost of the film, showing the importance and necessity of having competent and caring school staff. And yet we never directly hear from her. The film is shot as an observational documentary, and not once do we see Veland speak to the camera. She never tells us why she does what she does for these students. She never tells us how she manages the emotional roller coaster. But if you look hard enough, the answers can be found sprinkled throughout the film. In the end, The Bad Kids delivers an equally heartwarming and heartbreaking look at the lives of at-risk teens and the adults who fight for them. Even though the focus is on three specific students, you leave feeling like you understand the struggles of each and every Black Rock student, and you hope they don't continue walking uphill alone.
Now, Vox Magazine's Sarah Kleppel examines America's infatuation with incarceration in her review of The Prison in 12 Landscapes.
The United States incarcerates more citizens than any other country in the world. The prison system is a tangled web. In the film, The Prison in 12 Landscapes, director Brett Story tries to untangle that web and explain how mass incarceration has affected America's towns, lifestyles, and economy. The film is a thoughtful compilation of video essays that explore the prison culture in towns across the United States, from Detroit to Baltimore to Eastern Kentucky. We meet a radio host in Appalachia who coordinates an overwhelming amount of radio shout-outs from prisoners' loved ones. We're introduced to a man in the Bronx who helps inmates' families deliver care packages that meet obscure regulations. In California, we hear an inmate recount fighting forest fires in her prisoner firefighting unit. From Story's perspective, it's obvious our country is drawn to, maybe even obsessed with, the prison system. The film's catalog of faces and voices show how rooted the system is in many Americans' everyday lives. In one of the most compelling portions of the film, Story examines citizens in St. Louis County who are plagued by high fines for the most minor violations. One woman is forced to spend days in jail because she refuses to pay a fine. It's hundreds of dollars for not securing her trash can lid. Each of the film's video essays are framed by slow, rich, establishing shots. We see scorching trees in Marin County, bustling pathways in Washington Square Park, and powerful protests in Baltimore. It's awe-inspiring to visit these unique, eccentric landscapes, but then it's confounding, upsetting even, to witness communities so deeply controlled by a mysterious system. Story's film might answer one question, but it asks even more.
Finally, Vox Magazine's Griffin Mattis sheds light on an intimate family portrait in his review of Between Sisters.
Between Sisters asked a frightening question. What will you take to the grave? Italian filmmaker Manu Gerosa documented the strained relationship between his 68-year-old mother, Ornella, and her 89-year-old sister, Teresa. As Teresa grows older, her memories fade and her moods turn increasingly unhappy. She refuses to discuss death or the family history that Ornella never learned. Ornella's frustration with her sister's attitude drives the documentary, although it does occasionally drag with some very long, drawn-out shots. Watching Ornella grapple with the pain of watching someone she loves fade away a little bit more every day is moving, but the film is successful for another simple reason. There's no exposition here. No nameplates at the bottom of the screen. No one talking to the camera for introductions. This is an intensely personal home movie. Gerosa does an admirable job separating his filmmaker self and his family self, hardly ever speaking when not on screen. The result is an honest documentary about life, aging, death, family, and the connection between all of those things. The natural symbolism in this film is striking. Shots are almost amateur, but their beauty is undeniable. The occasional camera refocus or shake reiterates the private nature of the film. Gerosa's professionalism and love for his mother and aunt combine to create a touching and beautiful experience. Death lurks at every moment of the film. The failing health of Teresa is visible after her return from the hospital, and she asks if it would have been better for her to die in her bed than to have gone to the hospital. A framed picture of the Egyptian scale of life hangs just over her shoulder as she contemplates the value of her life and choices. These discussions become increasingly frequent as Arnella seeks answers about their family history, despite Teresa's protests about the pain of revealing the secrets in their family. During an argument about sickness, Arnella sadly tells her that there are no remedies for diseases of the soul. Arnella's right, but the humanity within Between Sisters is a brilliant effort to relieve the pain of life's struggles.
All of these film reviews were produced in conjunction with Vox Magazine. You can find them on our website, kbia.org, or at voxmagazine.com. Before we go, let's go back one more time to Ryan Levy's interview with Stacey Wolfel, the director of MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism.
So we know a lot of folks will get one of the various level of passes and will be seeing films throughout the weekend. Some folks maybe don't have that kind of time or money, and they're looking for the big value pop. Mm-hmm. They want one film to really make their true false experience. What would be, if someone's got one film, where can they head?
We've talked about some great films, and so any of those would be good for that one film. But the thing I'll put in your head is go to a shorts collection, because for two good reasons. Shorts don't have a good place to play someplace else. Netflix doesn't run shorts on their own. HBO typically doesn't. So one of the only places to see good documentary shorts is at a film festival, and this is the film festival that comes to us. So there are four shorts programs. They are always at least loosely constructed around a theme, and so you can read what that theme's about, and of course online you can see what the individual films are there. I've seen a number of the shorts, and I enjoy them all. I do enjoy shorts a lot. So we have a director who's returning, who had a short last year, Hotel 22, about the bus route that serves as a make-do homeless shelter in Silicon Valley. She's back with a short called Bison Head that looks at the clash between hunters, maybe we should call them poachers, and Native Americans up in the out in the West, and a bison hunt that goes on there. A.J. Schnock, who is a Mizzou alum and has had a number of documentaries, We Always Lie to Strangers and Caucus and some others, has a short that looks at the issue of gun violence that's playing. There's one called Territory that is a more or less wordless documentary about the clash between the humans and the macaque monkeys that live on Gibraltar, and it's funny and fun to watch. There's another one called Varicella that looks at a pair of sisters, but one in particular, young ballerina dancers in Russia, and what that life is like for them, told in a very artistic way. Victor Kosakowski, who's had a number of films in the festival, is the director of that. And so you can go on and on. I think there are about 25 or 30 shorts altogether across those four programs. And so sort of in value for the dollar, if that's all the time you have, you might pick one of the shorts collections to go see that.
Excellent. Stacey Wolfel, thank you for joining us.
You bet.
That was KBIA's Ryan Levy speaking with Stacey Wolfel, the director of MU's Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism. You can find an extended version of Ryan's interview with Wolfel on our website, kbia.org. That's where you can also find all of our true-false coverage, including the film reviews you heard tonight and all of our true-false conversations with filmmakers. Thanks for listening to KBIA's True-False Preview Special. I'm Ryan Famuliner.